is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, October 4th, 2004. At the main hospital, bodies in black plastic bags were loaded on a truck to be taken to the cemetery. In Samara, 200,000 people living without electricity and water, as 2,000 U.S. troops and 3,000 Iraqi soldiers sweep into the city, house to house, after days of rapid and heavy bombardment. Residents in the outlying areas emerged from their homes for the first time on Saturday, October 2nd, to survey the damage. Many bodies were strewn in the streets but couldn't be collected. Others were buried in people's gardens. A 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. curfew was in effect. At the Samara General Hospital, Dr. Khalid Ahmed said that at least 80 bodies and more than 100 wounded were brought to the facility. But many residents couldn't take their wounded for treatment because of gunfire from the American troops, who, along with the Iraqi forces, were arresting any persons above the age of 15 and thus preventing anyone from reaching the hospital. An ambulance driver said, quote, "Dead bodies and injured people are everywhere in the city. When we tried to evacuate them, the Americans fired at us. The wounded people, women and children, lay on their beds at Tikrit Teaching Hospital. His pregnant mother was killed," said one man, Sami Hashim, standing over a young boy whose own belly was covered in bandages. Nearby was a young girl who lost her left foot. Today, on Taking Aim, stripping away the facade, the results of the first Kerry Bush debate. Ralph?
This was a debate which presumptively was a disagreement about the nature of the war in Iraq. But indeed, when you look at the kind of discussion that took place, what the discussion and debate was about was how Kerry proposed to focus his, as he put it, the war on terror, not only in Afghanistan, but in Korea and Iran, and to take out Saudi Arabia as well. And he not only rehabilitated the idea of preemption, but he reinvented history by proposing and suggesting, did Kerry, that preemptive strike on the part of the United States was a standard feature of U.S. imperial policy throughout the Cold War, when in reality it was under Reagan that the notion of preemptive strike was first unleashed, and prior to that it was a focus on what was called containment, in its own way no less vicious. The significance of preemption in the hands of Mr. Kerry is as follows. He wants to increase the military capacity of the United States. For all his bad-mouthing the decision to invade Iraq, he declared his determination to win it no matter what, and that he had a better plan to do it. But when you look carefully at what he means by preemption, as was articulated by Obama, Barack, first strike, preemptive strike against Iran is one of the objectives that this presumptive Kerry administration would have. And holding the Saudis responsible for 9/11, as he stated, we will wage a war on terror every bit as total as the war we wage on the terrorists themselves. He drew his biggest round of applause when he declared, "I will do what President Bush has not. I will hold the Saudis accountable." And he stated there has been no public prosecution of the terror finances in Saudi Arabia, reiterating a theme that had been articulated as long ago as 1979, when the U.S. had made its position very clear with respect to the Saudis. It's about taking out the Saudis, as if this feudal monarchy would take on the $10 trillion state on its own, and 9/11 could be laid at its door. Pretext for a long-standing policy, carve up Arabia as Iraq has been carved up, ad seriatim. The nature of this discussion and this debate is to extricate the United States from its sole occupation of Iraq by bribing imperial allies, cutting them in on the spoils. That's the Kerry strategy. Bigger killer, more war, longer range, increased funding for it.
Ralph, he said specifically, I can make America safer than President Bush has made us. We are leading the world and we are leading strong alliances. That's when he believes America is, quote, safest and strongest. But he'll never give a veto to any country over our security. And that was his way of saying, yes, I am for preemption and I will do whatever it takes. Exactly what President Bush had said. Although he said, I have a better plan to fight the war on terror, let's look at what he meant by his better plan. Strengthening our military. And he said specifically, adding yet another division, more money for the military. And also when he complained about soldiers having to buy their own body armor and Humvees that didn't have enough armament to provide protective covering, that meant even more money diverted from social services here in the United States, more yet than half of all the discretionary federal money in the budget going towards the military. Yes, he has a better plan to be able to fight the war on terror. This fake war, something both Bush and Kerry agree. This nation is at war. But as we have said over and over again on Taking Aim, the war is on the American people. That is the war, not this fake war on terror. What he means, strengthening our military, and again, strengthening our intelligence. What does he mean by strengthening our intelligence? Reinforcing the Patriot Act, reinforcing all the incursions into the privacy and the daily life of you and me and other people here in the United States.
It's interesting that when he was invoking the support that he enjoys from the military, the Pentagon, chiefs of Joint Chiefs of Staff, he cited in particularly General Shinseki, who had called for at least 200,000 troops in Iraq, and he indicated that Shinseki was right. And indeed, that's the Kerry stratagem, to increase the number of troops. He had once called for 40,000 increase, and it's clear he intends it to be a continuing process. He invoked General Shalikashvili, the butcher of the Balkans, who had targeted working-class quarters of every major city in Serbia and in Bosnia and in Kosovo and in Montenegro and in Croatia. This, indeed, is the role of the ruling class, to debate about the tactics of imperial conquest, but always to seek the way in which to incrementally advance the military component of U.S. imperial reach. And specific to this question, when he was demagogically saying to Mr. Bush that Bush had been giving tax cuts to the rich, what Kerry didn't bother to cite was the fact that only a few days before, on September 23rd, in the United States Senate, the vote in support of these tax cuts by another $146 billion, extending them to 2009, was 93-4, something like 359-65 in the House. The Democratic Party lining up to support the tax cuts for the super wealthy and the corporations. Kerry and Edwards not even bothering to show up for the vote.
Ralph. Neither Kerry nor Edwards showed up, showing their full support for that tax cut measure. Tax cuts for people, as Kerry mentioned, like himself and President Bush. Let's go again to the debate and a quote from John Kerry. Quote, I believe in being strong and resolute and determined, and I will hunt down and kill the terrorists wherever they are. End quote. Let's go and see what he means and what President Bush mean by hunting down the terrorists. October 3rd, 2004, an article by Kim Sengupta in the Guardian. Onslaught on Samarra escalates in dress rehearsal for major U.S. assault on rebels. The attack on Samarra, writes Kin Semgupta from Baghdad, by more than 5,000 U.S. and Iraqi interim government troops, is the first on a, quote, no-go rebel enclave. It is seen as a dress rehearsal to wrest back other such areas, including Sadr City on the outskirts of Baghdad, and especially Fallujah. The U.S. aircraft are firing missiles into packed tenements in Sadr City. The resulting carnage they treat as claims of precision strikes on targets in Fallujah, but the people who have witnessed it treat this with deep skepticism. Dead bodies and injured people are lying everywhere in the city. The Americans fired at us when we tried to evacuate them, said an ambulance driver. And later on they told us we can evacuate only women and children, but cannot pick up injured men.
Well, actually, Maya, as you cite this article, it is very, very clear that what is being described here is an indiscriminate assault upon the most vulnerable of the civilian population. Quote, standing over a young boy with his stomach wrapped in bandages and his arm in a cast, Sami Hashem said that the hospital nearby, his pregnant mother was killed in front of him. On another bed lay a young girl who had lost her foot. The residents complained that they could not take their wounded to the hospital as the U.S. troops were arresting any Iraqi male over the age of 15 and firing on anyone who moved. Thousands of people attempted to flee the city, where U.S. forces cut off power and water, and American snipers on rooftops fired at anything that moved. The doctors at Samarra General Hospital described bodies brought in, 11 women, 5 children, 7 elderly men within a space of a few moments. Even as the article describes by the violent and anarchic standards of Iraq, the past days have taken a huge toll on the civilian population living in a state of siege.
The press reports, and this one by Kim Segupta was in The Independent rather than in The Guardian, are very similar, such as the one I first cited at the beginning of the show from The Wall Street Journal, but then also in The Washington Post, U.S. Iraqi forces control Samarra, from October 3rd, the report by Carl Vick. And here he quotes the Interior Minister Fala Naqib, who is a native of Samarra. And one thing that's important to note, that this attack, this all-out bombardment, the all-out assault, the all-out devastation of Samarra, came with the approval of Iyad Alawi and the entire Iraqi government infrastructure. This is the first step in operations to take back lawless area, Interior Minister Naqib told reporters at City Hall. The Iraqi government is moving from a defense position to an offensive position to regain control over all of Iraq. We cleaned up the city from all the bad guys and terrorists, Naqib said.
You know, Maya, one of the things that the American press featured in particular was the car bombs in Baghdad that killed 46 people and injured 208, the vast majority of them children. And the press was attempting to impute to the insurgents the actual targeting of the insurgents. And listen to what The Independent describes. It says, at yesterday's funerals, the bereaved families put the blame squarely on the American troops, who arrived and then seduced and attracted the children by handing out sweets. And as they handed out sweets to attract the children to them, they were using the children as shields. So when they came under fire, and when these invading troops were met by bombs, it was the children who took the first barrage. And that is the circumstance in which the 46 children and 208, 46 dead and 208 injured transpired. The article, 14,800 Iraqi civilians killed so far, 40,000 injured, and the British deputy commander says that the figure is likely to be higher than 50,000. Iraq's ever-rising toll, the death toll of children in the bombing of Baghdad, the largest in any insurgent attack was in fact aimed at the U.S. troops. 129 mass casualty bombings. This is an ongoing process of resistance to occupation and reaction to the indiscriminate destruction of the civilian areas of the cities. Here's the Scotland on October 2nd, U.S. forces to flatten Fallujah before Iraq's first war vote. Quote Stephen Breen's article, while all eyes are on the U.S. presidential election on November 2nd, the White House is preoccupied with another poll. Indeed, the insurgency in Iraq intensifies and the conflict dominates the political agenda. And consequently, the U.S. military have signaled that they intend to increase incursions into the key Iraqi cities, and U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld stated that the insurgencies in Fallujah and the city of Ramadi would be eliminated, they would be destroyed. That destruction has been taking the form of total war upon the civilian population itself, because it is the civilian population that sustains the insurgency through its sympathy, through its support, through its antipathy to the occupation.
Ralph, a very important letter has been circulating over the internet. It is a letter from Wall Street Journal correspondent Farnaz Fashihi. Farnaz Fashihi had written to her friends, and then her friends distributed her letter throughout the internet. She has confirmed that it is her letter. She is a Wall Street Journal correspondent in Baghdad who writes often with the noted Wall Street Journal correspondent Greg Jaffe. And let us look at what her letter says. In it, she remarks, being a foreign correspondent in Baghdad these days is like being under virtual house arrest. I am housebound. In Baghdad, I am a security personnel first, a reporter second. It's hard to pinpoint when the turning point exactly began. Was it in April when Fallujah fell out of the grasp of Americans? Was it when Sadr City, home to 10% of Iraq's population, became a nightly battlefield for the Americans? Or was it when the insurgency began spreading from isolated pockets in the Sudi Triangle to include most of Iraq? Now, she says that the Iraqis call what is taking place the situation. What they mean by the situation is this, she writes. The Iraqi government does control most of Iraqi citizens. There are several car bombs going off each day around the country, killing and injuring scores of people. The country's roads are becoming impassable, and they're littered by hundreds of landmines and explosive devices aimed to kill American soldiers. There are assassinations, kidnappings, and beheadings. In fact, in 4 days, 110 people died and over 300 were injured in Baghdad alone. The numbers are so shocking that the Ministry of Health, which was attempting an exercise of public transparency by releasing the numbers, has now stopped disclosing them. Insurgents, she says, now attack Americans 87 times a day. What she doesn't write here is about the devastating, the murderous, the bombings and the missile attacks by the Americans that are promoting and provoking such attacks.
Maya, every day the newspaper report is even more dramatic in Great Britain and in the European press. Here is News 24. Women and kids predominate amongst the wounded on October 2nd with respect to Fallujah. Dr. Ahmed Tahir at the Fallujah's General Hospital counted numerous children and women received at the hospital every hour. The strike of the United States on Friday was the latest in a series of continual indiscriminate bombings. And here's the Los Angeles Times. Casualties of Samarra, this is October 2nd, Thomas Mulligan and Suhail Ahmed, casualties of Samarra offensive overwhelm all local services. As U.S.-led forces consolidate their control over Samarra, humanitarian officials described a hellish scene within the city. The morgue in Samarra's main hospital is filled to overflowing. Required the civilian dead to be laid out on the floor in an unrefrigerated hall, said Noura Abdelbakr, director of the Red Crescent branch in the northern Iraqi province of Salahuddin, where Samarra is located. She cited reports from the Red Crescent volunteers who had been to the hospital. Hundreds of civilians brought in and laid out, indiscriminately killed, in their homes, in their houses, in their streets. Ambulances unable to travel into the neighborhoods to pick up the injured and the dying. Bodies lying in the streets, witnesses in Adawar said. The refugee camp, a tent village built by the Red Crescent, had received only a handful of the residents because the population, wounded and injured, could not reach it. Tikrit described the plight of Samarra. Volunteers in buses and trucks gathering on the northern outskirts of the city, desperately trying to reach the dying and the injured and the wounded. We are encouraging people to stay in their homes. However, we are not denying people the right to leave the city, said Major General Neil O'Brien, a spokesman for the U.S. Army's 1st Infantry Division, which is leading the offensive. Encouraging people to stay in their homes, those are the homes that they are targeting with missiles and JDAMs and 5,000-pound bombs. Quote, U.S. aircraft again pounded targets in sprawling Sadr City district of Baghdad Friday night and early Saturday as the military continued attacking the population, and indeed it is in every part of Iraq.
Ralph, going back to the email letter to her friends by Farnaz Fashihi, she describes what is taking place in Sadr City and the rebellion against the American occupation. Quote, a friend drove through the Shiite slum of Sadr City yesterday. He said young men were openly placing improvised explosive devices into the ground. They melt a shallow hole into the asphalt, dig the explosive, cover it with dirt, and put an old tire or plastic can over it to signal to the locals this is booby trap. He said on the main roads of Sadr City, there are a dozen landmines per every 10 yards. His car snaked and swirled to avoid driving over them. Behind the walls sit an angry Iraqi, ready to detonate them as soon as an American convoy gets near. This is in Shiite land, the population that was supposed to love America for liberating Iraq. The insurgency, we are told, she continues, is rampant with no signs of calming down. If anything, it is growing stronger, organized, and more sophisticated every day. My friend Georges, the French journalist snatched on the road to Najaf, has been missing for a month with no word on release of whether he is still alive. America's last hope for a quick exit? The Iraqi police and National Guard units we are spending billions of dollars to train. The cops are being murdered by the dozens every day, over 700 to date, and the insurgents are infiltrating their ranks. The problem is so serious that the U.S. military has allocated $6 million to buy out 30,000 cops they just trained to get rid of them quietly.
Maya Al Jazeera on October 1st. U.S. forces continue to pound Samarra and Fallujah. It's round the clock. U.S. airport aircraft bombarding the cities, tanks patrolling the streets 24 hours after the offensive is launched, indiscriminate firing of the tank cannon, no less than the aircraft saturation bombing, and the result, civilians wounded and dying in the streets, children and women unable to be received at the hospital. Dr. Ahmed Tahir at Fallujah's General Hospital stating that they are overwhelmed. Even those that are not able to reach the hospital are dwarfed by the numbers who are lying in the wards unattended. Their facilities are destroyed as well. It is carnage. Al Jazeera again. U.S. Fallujah raids kill children. Victims of the Dawn raid, and again, this is September 30th, every day, were rushed to Fallujah's General Hospital, where Dr. Abd al-Hakim al-Badrani confirmed the vast civilian toll. A local journalist, Abu Bakr al-Dulami, said the homes in the Duhlat district had been completely flattened, killing fathers and mothers and children and creating a sense of mass outrage throughout the city. each report is more gruesome than the one that precedes it. Here we have the San Francisco Chronicle. The morning Iraqis blame U.S. troops for the massacre of the children, reiterating what I had cited before, how, quote, the families of 35 children who died in a string of bombings blame American troops for the tragedy, accusing them of attracting the children in order to provide a shield for themselves, and consequently, when the troops are fired upon, the children are the victims. Families free, U.S. pounding of Fallujah. Again, this goes back to September 7th. This is a continuing, ongoing onslaught. As Al Jazeera describes, the destruction of an entire neighborhood, the southern Shuhada district and industrial zone, U.S. warplanes bombarding it, as well as the eastern corridor of the city on a constant and continuing basis. These are cities, and these are civilian areas with no means of defense against these indiscriminate rounds of airstrikes. Another round of U.S. airstrikes on Fallujah, describes Peter Simmons on September 29th. American warplanes once again mounting heavy strikes on the Iraqi city of Fallujah on Sunday in what has become a daily exercise aimed at terrorizing a population of some 300,000 people into submission.
As Farnaz Fashihi writes to her friends, one could argue that Iraq is already lost beyond salvation. End quote. By salvation, what does she mean? She means the occupation of the American troops, the occupation, the capture of the U.S. oil. In fact, what the Iraqis have wanted for years, for many, many years, from the days of the Iraqi Revolution, is self-determination. And it is the U.S. with the CIA and its collaboration with Saddam Hussein, that prevented the Iraqi self-determination. Ralph?
Well, the CBS report on the method through which, quote, U.S. wrests Samarra from the militants is evocative. U.S. warplanes hammered the cities, killing people indiscriminately. Again, this is an article in the mainstream press. Firebrand Shiite Mukhtar al-Sadr told Iraqi leaders that the killing is nonstop. Indeed, the description that we have given in paper after paper is painfully similar in each city, in each population location. And what are the conclusions that are drawn by analysts in various countries? Quote, far graver than Vietnam, writes Sidney Blumenthal in The Guardian. Most senior U.S. military officers now realize that the war in Iraq has turned into a disaster on an unprecedented scale. And what they're describing is the consequence of this indiscriminate killing that the U.S. occupation forces and their air force are inflicting on the Iraqi population. I see no ray of light on the horizon at all. The worst case has become true, said Jeffrey Record, professor of strategy at the Air War College. There is no analogy whatsoever between the situation in Iraq and the advantages we had after the Second World War in Germany and Japan. This is Vietnam Redux. I don't think you can kill an insurgency. This anti-U.S. insurgency centered in the Sunni triangle and spreading to the Shiite areas of Iraq, cities and towns, is expanding and becoming more capable as a direct consequence of U.S. policy.
A direct consequence, yes, that is exactly what Farnaz Fashihi and Greg Jaffe concluded. Rebel attacks in Iraq reveal new cooperation, their article of September 15th in the Wall Street Journal. The quote, the insurgents are no longer operating in isolated pockets of their own. They are well connected and cooperating, Sabah Khadim, a senior advisor to Iraq's Interior Ministry, which oversees the police and security around the country, commented to these Wall Street Journal reporters. This is the story again and again. Their conclusion, Iraq's once highly fragmented insurgent groups are increasingly cooperating to attack the U.S. and Iraqi government targets and steadily gaining control of more areas around the country. We will return in a moment after this station identification.
Our next Speaker, I think, needs no introduction from me. So please give the warmest welcome to Tony Benn.
Hello, this is Tony Benn, and you're listening to WBAI Pacifica, your peace and justice radio station at 99.5 FM here in New York.
We are here today to found a new political movement worldwide.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Stripping Away the Facade, the First Kerry-Bush Debate. We'll go on with our second part, but first I'd like to remind you that in less than 2 weeks, the Million Worker March is going to take place Sunday, October 17th at noon at the Lincoln Memorial. Ralph, do you want to give people a short update about what how the preparations are proceeding?
Well, everybody is getting on the bus. The American Postal Workers Union is mobilizing 1,350 chapters. In fact, on every union bulletin board and every post office in the United States, the word has gone out from President William Burroughs, get on the bus, get on the march, mobilize for the 17th of October. And indeed, what is happening now is that people are taking ownership of the Million Worker March. Spontaneous groups, the anti-war movement, welfare mothers, youth, and students are all mobilizing to provide a movement of fight back, mobilizing in our own name, a working people's agenda, independent of all the politicians, independent of the two parties. We are building a movement to respond to the fact that neither party and neither candidate is capable or interested in addressing the urgent needs of the vast majority of our people. The absence of health care, the onslaught on our standards of living. The Forbes report, which we were citing most recently, Maya, indicates that by now 1% of the population owns more than the 95% of the population combined. It worsens, it deepens, poverty increases. By now we have a circumstance in which poverty is defined as $12,000 a year for a family of four, as if people could survive an individual on $3,000 a year. In reality, the 36 million people who are said to be in poverty are a fraction of the real number. The Million Worker March is about challenging this paradigm. It's about seizing the initiative. It's about mobilizing in our own name. Everybody, please, to Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial on October 17th.
And now, to return to the first Kerry-Bush debate, and particularly their agreement on maintaining the occupation of Iraq, boosting the military might against the peoples of Iraq. Again, The Wall Street Journal, September 15th, 2004. The area that the U.S. officials call insurgent enclaves has grown from a patchwork of cities to include most of Anbar province, which fans out to the northwest of Baghdad. Now, one approach, the main approach of the United States military forces, is shown by the recent assault on Tal Afar, a small city that had been dominated by insurgents. In other words, that the Americans could not control because the Iraqi peoples were maintaining control of it themselves. U.S. planes bombed the city for several days. Now, it's hard to describe what it means just with the innocuous word, bomb the city, because what they mean are these JDAMs, these huge incredibly heavy-weighted bombs that destroy everything in their path and for long distances beyond that. So the U.S. planes bombed the city, bomb after bomb, raiding the city for several days. And then the U.S. troops operating with Iraqis took the city with house-to-house fighting.
Well, Maya, what Kerry was saying to Bush was, I have a plan and I will win this war. And basically he was talking about the equivalent of Vietnamization, i.e. substituting Iraqi troops and forces under American officer direction for the American grunts who are asked to slaughter the Iraqi people. It's worse than you think, is the headline in Newsweek on September 20th. Iraqis don't shock easily these days, but eyewitnesses could only blink in disbelief as they recounted the nonstop raids upon the cities on the population of Iraq. 16 months after the war, supposed an Iraq insurgency is spreading. And indeed, it says U.S. forces are working frantically to train Iraqis for the thankless job of maintaining public order. The aim is to boost Iraq's security forces from 95,000 to 200,000 by sometime next year. And then, with a mixture of Iraqi and U.S. force, the Americans plan to retake the cities and install credible local forces. That's the hope, anyway. But the quality of the recruits is debatable. And it describes how, in recent demonstrations in Najaf, the police opened fire on crowds indiscriminately, killing and injuring people, and the insurgents are recruiting, too. So we have in Newsweek an acknowledgement that we have a situation that makes Vietnam look tame by comparison. The situation, as Newsweek describes it, is much worse than you think. And so does, says the Washington Post on September 29th, growing pessimism on Iraq. Doubts increase within U.S. security agencies. A growing number of career professionals within national security agencies believe that the situation in Iraq is much worse and the path to success much more tenuous than is being expressed in public by top administration officials. While Bush, Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, and others delivered optimistic public appraisals, officials who fight the Iraqi insurgency and study it at the CIA and the State Department and within the Army Officer Corps believe the rebellion is deeper, more widespread, and more popular than publicly acknowledged officials state.
In the debate, John Kerry stated, more soldiers killed in June than before, more in July than June, more in August than July, more in September than in August. It's getting worse by the day. His solution, just one sentence later, we don't have enough troops there. We don't have enough troops there. More troops, that's John Kerry's solution. As the Newsweek article, It's Worse Than You Think, noted, another ominous sign is the growing number of towns that U.S. troops simply avoid. A senior defense official objects to calling them no-go areas. We could go into them any time we wanted, he argues. The preferred term is insurgent enclaves. They're spreading, Newsweek notes. Counterinsurgency experts call it the ink blot strategy. Take control of several towns or villages and expand outward until the areas merge. What Newsweek doesn't note is what they mean by taking control. Massive bombardment. Destroy these towns and villages. Wipe them off the face of the earth. The first city, Newsweek notes, lost to the insurgents was Fallujah in April. Now the list includes the Sunni Triangle cities of Ar-Ramadi, Baquba, and Samarra. There is no security force in Fallujah, no local government, says a senior U.S. military official in Baghdad. We would get attacked constantly. Forget about it. John Kerry's plan for Iraq? Increase the troop level of U.S. forces.
Well, when you look carefully at who we're talking about here, John Kerry has as his principal advisors such figures as Richard Morningstar, who indeed was taking over from Oliver North for Reagan in FEMA and in counterinsurgency. And then you have Rand Beers, who was performing a similar role and had indeed responsibility for under Clinton for the operation of the paramilitary forces in Colombia and the destruction of the crops of the Colombian peasants. And then he goes on to administer the color coding of the terror threat for George W. Bush. And now he's the chief national security advisor for John Kerry. And then you have William Perry, who was the main lobbyist for Martin Marietta, who facilitated the merger with Lockheed, and who indeed is associated with the Carlyle Group, which is a who's who of the Republican Party, the $14 billion defense and pharmaceutical conglomerate of the Bush family. These are the people who are guiding Mr. Kerry. As I mentioned so many times before, his brother Cameron Kerry, in his special visit to Jerusalem to confer with Sharon, criticized Bush for not being sufficiently supportive of Israel and of Sharon, and called for and supported a preemptive strike on Iran, on Tehran, on the nuclear power facilities of Tehran, much as Obama-Barack had called for. So we really do see that the Kerry-Bush debate is a squabble about tactics and positioning of themselves. It's evocative, I think it's worth mentioning, of the famous debate between John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon in 1960, when Richard Nixon took the position that the proper way to handle Fidel Castro and the new Cuban Revolution was with diplomacy and with attempts to seduce and to contain and to restrain. Whereas Kennedy called it a cancer in the Americas in those debates and vowed that he would remove that cancer by military force if necessary. Of course, in reality, at the time that Nixon was disavowing any such intent, in the National Security Council, Nixon, as vice president, was preparing for the Bay of Pigs, the Bay of Pig invasion. And there you have essentially the role of these figures positioning themselves and posturing, Bush declaring that he would not contemplate additional preemptive wars such as the one in Iraq and these supposed debates, while Kerry saying that preemption was a policy that he would pursue. So you see that they position themselves, they reverse themselves, they debate about tactics, about a shared objective, which is to extend imperial reach, and there's only one meaning of that, deepening the assault on working people at home, attacking our living standards, taking away our meager health care provisions, assaulting our schools and our housing, even more severely than they have been up to now. That is the consensus. Whatever demagogic references may be made to the tax cuts put by the wealthy by Mr. Kerry in the Senate and in the House, he and his party supported exactly that.
Ralph, an article in the New York Times, September 25th, by Robin Toner, Kerry promises to refocus U.S. war on terror. She reports on a couple of events at which John Kerry spoke, and he outlined his statements that actually he made in the debates. One of them, though, is very interesting, at the University of Pennsylvania. He told the cheering crowd that America was, quote, locked in a real struggle with terrorism that it must win. That it must win a struggle with terrorism. Again, this is the mantra of both John Kerry and President Bush. They both have that same analysis, that there is a war on terror, a war on terror outside the United States, not the war on terror that they are putting upon the people of the United States. And as President Bush notes of John Kerry, both he and John Kerry accept the premise that Saddam Hussein was a threat, not a threat to the Iraqi people themselves, but a threat to the people of the United States. And part of that was that Saddam Hussein was going to acquire and build nuclear weapons. In the New York Times, there is a three full-page article by David Barstow, William Broad, and Jeff Girth that tries to make it seem as if the New York Times didn't participate in revving up the vocal call for an attack against Iraq. It's called How the White House Embraced Disputed Arms Intelligence, making it seem as if there was misinformation from the CIA, when in fact this was an orchestrated plan by the president and Dick Cheney and the administration, orchestrated by the New York Times and the Washington Post and the other bourgeois media for the assault on Iraq. I suggest you all look at it. It's available on the website as well as in the Sunday New York Times. And what is significant is that Condoleezza Rice still is supporting what was called irrefutable evidence that thousands of tubes of high-strength aluminum tubes were going to be used to make Iraqi uranium centrifuges, and some of them, in fact, had been seized in Jordan by the United States. When, as the Iraqis had said, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commissions in the United States noted, these are aluminum tubes that the Iraqis had been using to create their rockets for many, many years. Another debunking of the basis for the U.S. assault on Iraq, an assault on Iraq that wouldn't take place even on the basis if Iraq was building a nuclear centrifuge for uranium. Ralph.
Well, it's interesting that there's an article by Mike Rogers in LouRockwell.com on September 18th, which is called The Coming Invasion of Iran. And it cites the particular decision and preoccupation of Kerry and his associates with the necessity to take out Iran. You find that Bush has been giving lip service to this through the neocons, but the Kerry people have been actually making preparations for taking out Iran. And that is what they see Sharon as the cat's paw for facilitating. But it's worthwhile here, as the article cites, to call to people's attention the fact that Iran is three times the population of Iraq, that Iran has a far more sophisticated armed capacity than did Saddam Hussein, and that the consequence of this adventure of attempting to seize oil in Iran as they have in Iraq will mean that the U.S. Will be undertaking an occupation that will dwarf the consequences of Iraq itself. Look at the article in the Washington Post yesterday, Influx of Wounded Strains, Veterans Administration, thousands of U.S. troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan with physical injuries and mental health problems are encountering a benefit system that is vastly overburdened. Officials and veteran groups are concerned that the challenge will grow as the nation remains at war. The disability benefits and health care systems that provide services for 5 million American veterans are so overloaded and have been for decades that the current backlog of over 300,000 claims means that returning veterans who are injured have a very slight chance of getting any treatment at all. And it says because they were mobilized to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, nearly 150,000 National Guard and Reservist veterans are eligible for health care and benefits, and the number is rising, but they are not going to be receiving them. Quote, I love the military. That was my life. But I don't believe they're taking care of me now, said Sergeant Staff Sergeant Gene Westruck of Lawton, Oklahoma. Paralyzed through a mortar attack in April, he has received no disability benefits. He is supporting his wife and three children on his regular military pay of $2,800 a month. Through the end of April, the most recent accounting, the VA could provide a total of 166,334 veterans of operations in Iraq and Afghanistan separated from the military service filed benefits for claims for service-connected disability, and the majority of these claims are not being processed. It describes a circumstance in which veterans and the injured, the cannon fodder of these wars of imperial conquest, are utterly neglected, and that the circumstances that afflict these veterans are only the very small beginning of what will happen as these wars of conquest are met by resistance in the ongoing future.
Ralph, and these articles don't even mention the long-term results of depleted uranium, because remember, in the initial bombardment of Iraq, in those first days of the massive JDAM bombardment, there was the use of depleted uranium, and depleted uranium coats all the armor, the tank of the bullet, not bullets, but the rockets and missiles that are fired from the tanks, and also
bullets also are coated with the depleted uranium, the hardest metal substance there is. There is an increase of radiation in Iraq 250,000 times greater than that which followed in Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the atomic bombings.
And we still are seeing the effects with the Gulf War veterans, as we have mentioned on many Taking Aim programs. The Gulf War veterans are not getting their treatment, and the government has been fighting against their claims. And there are still hundreds of thousands of Gulf War veterans who require treatment.
Over 200,000 who have got neurological damage from the forced anthrax vaccinations, as well as the exposure to depleted uranium.
And still the veterans from the Vietnam War, from the Agent Orange, and the effects of it that Agent Orange had not only on the veterans, and also the effects of depleted uranium, not just on the veterans, but on their families.
Maya, here is a brief summation of what the war of conquest in Iraq means. The Iraqi soldiers and insurgents killed since May 1st, 2003, 24,000. Iraqi civilians killed since March, 12,800. The number of insurgents in Iraq, 20,000 today by the most conservative estimates. Today, the percentage of Americans who believe that the Iraq war has worsened and should not continue, 69%. These realities are not reflected in the little game of punitive debate that proceeds between Kerry and Bush, two reflections of the same structure of power, whose disagreements are solely about the tactics of maintaining imperial reach.
Yes, and that came across loud and clear in the debate, because John Kerry said, "I believe that we have to win this," meaning the assault, the occupation of Iraq. "The president and I have always agreed on that."
"Crude dudes," writes Linda McQuaig in the Toronto Star, on September 20th, 2004. U.S. oil companies just happened to have billions of dollars that they wanted to invest in undeveloped oil reserves. From his corner office in the heart of New York's financial district, Fadel Gait keeps close tabs on what goes on inside the boardrooms of the big oil corporations. An oil analyst at the prestigious Wall Street firm Oppenheimer & Company, the fit, distinguished-looking Gait has been watching the oil industry closely for over 25 years. Selling the modern world's most indispensable commodity has never been a bad business to be in, particularly for that small group of companies that straddle the top of this privileged world, but never more so than now. Quote, "Profit-wise, things could not be better," said Gait. "In the last 3 years, they died and went to heaven. They're all sitting on the largest piles of cash in their history." What is he describing? The seizure of oil. Quote, "The cheap oil has already been found and developed and produced and consumed. The low-hanging fruit has already been picked, but not all the low-hanging fruit has been picked. Nestled into the heart of the area of the heaviest oil concentration in the world is Iraq, overflowing with low-hanging fruit. No permafrost, no deep water, just giant pools of oil right beneath the warm ground. This is the fruit sagging so low that it practically touches the ground under the weight of its ripeness. Not only does Iraq have vast quantities of easily accessible oil, but it is oil that is almost untouched. Think of Iraq as virgin territory. This is bigger than anything Exxon is involved in currently. It is the superstar of the future, and that's why Iraq had become the most sought-after real estate on the face of the earth." Linda McQuaig quotes this oil authority in the Toronto Star, and the article goes on to describe how from the inception of the Bush administration, they took the drawing board plans from 1964 of each administration and decided that the next and immediate task was the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Dick Cheney was pivotal in advancing the plans for regime change in Iraq. As CEO of oil services giant Halliburton, the article continues, Cheney was alert to the problem of securing these sources of oil. Speaking to the London Petroleum Institute in 1999 while still heading Halliburton, Cheney had difficulty focusing on the prospect of finding the 50 million extra barrels of oil per day that he said he would require.
Where are we going to get it? There's the Middle East with two-thirds of the world's oil and the lowest cost. That's where our prize ultimately lies, unquote. Kerry and Bush can bandy words all they want. What they are about is sustaining imperial reach, winning the wars that they start, bearing the consequences not for themselves but for the American people, involving us in further expansion of this imperial reach, cannibalizing the infrastructure of our society, and asking working people to bear the full burden, and terrorizing us with the prospect of demons they have funded and created in order to keep us submissive and acquiescent as they wage class war both here and abroad.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Stripping Away the Facade, the First Kerry Bush Debate. This program was recorded on October 4th. You're hearing it on Tuesday, October 5th. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net or takingaim@wbai.org. You can call us at 707-552-9995 or write to us by post at P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, California, 94591. This program will be on our archive on our internet site, www.takingaim.info. I want to thank Kathy Davis for coming in and recording the show for us, and here in Berkeley, Michael Yoshida, our engineer. We'll be with you next week.